Mickey!
Yeah!
Grab your coat! Then get your hat! Leave your worries on your doorstep! Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street! Now, can you hear? Hear that bitter cat? And that happy tune is a good step! Life could be so sweet! The street I used to walk in the shade.
Used to walk in the shade
with my blues on parade.
With your blues on parade.
Now I'm not afraid.
She's not afraid.
This rover
bang
crossed over.
No.
And if I never have a cent, I'd be rich as Rockefeller. Don't just have my feet on the sunny side.
Funny side.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 12, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning and welcome back. Where were you last week?
Cincinnati, seeing Mac and Mabel at the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music. Amazing. Let me also say right now that 2 years ago I discovered a young man at the International Thespian Festival in Nebraska named Alex Stone. Yes, that's the name of Donna Reed's husband on her TV series. Anyway, here he is. He's only a sophomore, and he got the lead in Mac and Mabel. I mean, isn't that amazing? And he was phenomenal in it. I predict big things for Alex Stone.
Wow.
Oh, great to hear. Also with us this morning is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And Michael, you turned me on to the whole Everything Sondheim, and I'm opening it up right here. What a beautiful first issue.
It is.
After we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, I ordered it. It came in the mail. Just a great, great thing that everybody should go out and order. Support this this group, because this is a wonderful group that you are working with. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, I think the graphics are very good, as well as the writing. So it's I'm so happy that they have morphed this into this other project, and they're really getting going. And as I think I mentioned, initially they were thinking of it primarily as a website, and they thought maybe we'll put out two hard copy editions per year. But the response has been so great that they're going to do four. They're going to be a quarterly, like the previous Sondheim review. So, and also, Peter, I almost forgot to mention, I spoke with the publisher, Rick Pender, or I guess editor in chief, maybe that's his title. Anyway, he said that you wrote about Everything Sondheim on. Now, where was it? Your blog for
Masterworks Broadway.
Yes, and he said that it got them 15 subscriptions.
Oh, how nice. Every little bit counts.
Absolutely.
Very happy.
I'm looking at the masthead here. Rick Pender is the executive editor and publisher. Michael, why don't you reach out to Rick and see if he can come on, and let's talk about Everything Sondheim.
Oh, I'm sure he'd love to. Yes, I will do so.
Yeah. It's really great. And it seems to be, such a Sondheim renaissance right now, with so many, Sunday in the Park is doing very well. The Sweeney Todd off Broadway is a very interesting thing. Are you guys scheduled to go see Sweeney Todd?
Yeah, I'm going on Tuesday.
All right, so we'll have to talk about that soon. With us this morning, we have a very special guest joining us by telephone from Ripley Greer, Deborah Grace Weiner. Deb is the 92nd Street Y Lyrics and Lyricists Series Artistic Director, as well as being an author and playwright who has written extensively about the American Songbook. She is the author of On the Sunny Side of the Street, The Life and Lyrics of Dorothy Fields, recently reissued on Amazon as an ebook, and The Night and the Music, Rosemary Clooney, Robert Crook, and Julie Wilson inside the world of cabaret. She's the co-author of Sing Out Louise, 150 Musical Stars Remember 50 Years, and I Remember Too Much, 89 Opera Stars Speak Candidly of Their Work, Their Lives, and Their Colleagues. And coming up at the 92nd Street Y, we have Baby Dream Your Dream, Dorothy Fields and the Women of the American Songbook coming up. So, Deb, thank you for getting up an extra hour early on Sunday morning and visiting with us.
Oh, anything for you guys. What a treat. Thank you for having me on.
So, Deb, tell us about the upcoming seminar at 92nd Street Y.
Well, it's actually a show, not a seminar. It's part of the Lyrics and Lyricists series. We are the oldest series of American Songbook concerts in the country. It's coming up on 50 years of having concerts celebrating the American Songbook. So we do five concerts a year, and they're quite produced. And we run from January to June, and we have five performances of each in the theater at the 92nd Street Y. And we are blessed to have as our performing family. We just have the wonderful sort of creative creme de la creme of Broadway putting the shows together and performing in them, and the jazz world and cabaret world as well. So it's really a joy to be artistic director of this wonderful series, which I've been able to shepherd for, I blinked and it's my eighth season. And so what we've got coming up is, this is my own personal entry into our season. I'm leading it and writing it and hosting it. And it's a celebration of the great women songwriters of Broadway and the American Songbook, particularly at that golden age time, the real pioneer gals like Dorothy Fields and Betty Comden and Carolyn Lee and Mary Rodgers, and to an extent, Marilyn Bergman, and then all these wonderful people in between.
Wow. Now, Dorothy Fields, of course, was the daughter of Lou Fields, who, of course, was a big vaudeville person. Weber and Fields was a famous act. Now, the question becomes,
right,
given that he had a daughter, did he encourage her to be in show business? Was he reluctant? Did she have a step up because of her father? Sometimes that
That's
can
a great
be liability.
Question. It's a great question. It is. He wanted her to do absolutely anything else besides being show business. It was a terrible, terrible thing. In fact, they were very aware. They had done well because, as you say, he was a great vaudeville star and also a producer. He had about three or four theaters that had his name on it. And Peter, you know all this. Do you know what was the great gag that Weber and Fields originated? Two things.
No, okay, unless it was there, Charlie. Go ahead.
Daylight savings time. So I'll tell you. They were credited with originating the custard pie in the face, and also the joke that started, "Who was that lady with? I saw you last night." That was no lady.
That was my wife.
That was their gag.
Uh-huh.
So the family was very aware. They were very successful because of that, but they tried to raise the children. They lived on West End Avenue, which was called the Gilded Ghetto, because a lot of well-heeled Jewish professionals like Richard Rodgers and his family lived up on Upper West End Avenue. But their mother, Rose Fields, used to tell the four children, "You have to be more polite than other children because your father's an actor." So show business was so disreputable that they were very, very conscious of raising the children to be reputable. And especially for a girl at that time, Dorothy was born in 1905. So think of the time that she came of age. And when she announced to her family at the dinner table, I guess, that she and Jimmy McHugh were going to write songs for the Cotton Club. I mean, they were horrified.
Sure, sure. The I Can't Give You Anything But Love story, that wasn't it that she was walking by and she heard a guy say this to his girlfriend?
Yes, that's the way the story goes, yeah.
That's the way the story goes, but there's also some talk that Fats Waller was involved with that song. Do you know anything about that?
all I know about it is that that is not that is a story that I would not put any credibility behind from everything that I know. Yeah, there's a story going around about that her lyric was not about the lyrics, and this, you're talking about the thing about Andy Razoff and all of that. If you talk to historians about it, some of that is based on Andy Razoff's deathbed murmuring about something, and it's open to interpretation what he said. But I know a lot about Dorothy Fields, and I know that that she would, out of honor and pride, she would never. That was an original lyric, and there were certainly, I'll tell you, there were certainly many instances in those days of songs being kind of bought for a beer from African American writers and white songwriters, kind of buying out for a very small amount of money ideas and actual material. But this is not the case. As from
what's really interesting too is you mentioned Carolyn Lee, and of course Carolyn Lee was writing with Cy Coleman, who then Dorothy Fields was his next collaborator, and of course Cy Coleman is our favorite equal opportunity collaborator because he collaborated with so many women over the course of his life.
Isn't that interesting though? That interesting that Cy did collaborate with women and absolutely. Cy and Carolyn had the most successful partnership in writing. It was very tempestuous because Carolyn also was very, very emotional person. Brilliant, brilliant. She's one of my favorite lyricists ever in the history of lyricists. Yeah. I think she was brilliant when you think about songs like, all the work for Little Me or Peter Pan, songs like It Amazes Me and When in Rome. And think of how brilliant those lyrics are.
An earthiness that she had signature, that expression that's used when you can tell who's written the lyric, because all those earthy lyrics, you know, Don't Pass the Plate, So Many in How Now, Dow Jones, too, really got down and dirty. She was certainly a woman of the people when it came to writing lyrics, and very, very clever. So
You're right. Yeah, no, you're right. And she was hip and sexy and so smart. And there's an emotional pull about her. I think that Carolyn Lee is similar in a way to, or reminiscent of, Larry Hart in a way. They had this kind of whiff of personal unhappiness about them, and yet they had these sort of shimmering, optimistic lyrics. And Lee, I think of Carolyn Lee because she came along 30 years after Dorothy Fields. And I think that if you take Dorothy Fields and you run her through psychoanalysis, you get Carolyn Lee. That's how I think of it. Because she was not afraid to, she came of age in a different age when people were used to, when neurosis was in and being examined. And so it was an ordinary thing for people in their lives in the 50s and 60s to sort of examine those very complex sort of human emotions and things. And she was fearless in stripping herself bare in her lyrics in a way that many people were not. And yet she doesn't overdo it. Her relationship with Cy Coleman was very tempestuous, and they fought all the time. And yet it was so successful. And then when they broke up with each other, he actually ran into Dorothy Fields at a party at Sheldon Harnick's house, I believe, and asked her and said, "Hey, why don't we write something sometime?" And she basically said the equivalent of, "I thought you'd never ask." And they got along great. And of course did Sweet Charity within I think about a year later. And then of course Seesaw.
Ethan Morden, the marvelous musical theater historian, says that her lyrics seem to get younger as she seemed to get older. And I think there's something to be said for that.
I could not agree more. You know, Dorothy Fields had her hallmark, apart from brilliant craft and inventiveness, was the ability, her ear for slang. She had this ear for the colloquial and what was sort of going, what was the slang of the street in a way. And so when you think of a song like I Can't Give You Anything But Love, Baby, that's like a perfect example of that. And that ear, I think, is what preserved her. Way after, this is the interesting thing about Dorothy Fields. When I wrote my book, which is called On the Sunny Side of the Street, which is another example of a slangy, you know, grab your coat and get your hat and all that. The thing that I learned when I wrote my book is that she outlasted all her contemporaries in terms of the success of her career. So she was that original group. She was the only woman in that original, you know, blue chip legend group with Gershwin and Irving Berlin and Cole Porter and Richard Rodgers. And she fits with that. But when you think of what was happening in the 60s when rock and roll came in and the styles changed, all those people who were still alive and writing really struggled to find any kind of success, including the great Richard Rodgers and Irving Berlin. But she, think of it. She had these hits after all of those people had been sidelined, and she partnered with someone 25 years younger and went and wrote Sweet Charity and then Seesaw, which were very, you know, hip to their time. And I think that her ear, I sort of think that her ear for the slang and the colloquial maybe was what really saved her. Because she, you look at the lyrics to Sweet Charity, it's a lot like the stuff she wrote with Jimmy McHugh in the 20s.
I agree. Interestingly enough, she was going to do the lyrics as well for Annie Get Your Gun when they were going to when she was going to collaborate with Jerome Kern. Do you know if there was any resentment that followed after Irving Berlin came in and said, "Excuse me, I do my own lyrics and I'll do the entire score"?
It's a really great question. And you would think that the way it sort of went down was that that the show was her idea. Actually, and she said that she claimed that she was walking through Grand Central Station and saw this sharpshooter, this soldier who had been with a lot of sharpshooting medals because it was during the war, during World War II, and he had just come back from Coney Island or something like that and had all these stuffed animals, and he was a medaled, you know, military guy, and she said she said some ideas just pop into your head fully formed. And she thought Ethel Merman is Annie Oakley. And that she like rushed to Merman, who was having a baby. And she rushed to, and she saw Oscar Hammerstein and who were producing it. Rodgers and Hammerstein were producing at that time. And so that idea kind of got off the ground like within a day. And when Kern died very suddenly, and of course, as you say, she was supposed to write lyrics as well as the book. And when Kern died very suddenly, they all got together and tried to figure out what to do. And they first tried to get another composer in, and that didn't work. And then somebody said, well, what about Irving Berlin, who then turned it down. And then they were all kind of like sensitive to the idea that if Berlin did take the job, that would leave her out of that. But it was in consultation, and she said, you know what, if he took the job, it would be worth it, and I would step aside. And also remember, she was so heartbroken about what happened to Jerome Kern. They were very, very close, and it was so shocking. He just dropped dead on the street, basically, or collapsed on the street, and went into a coma, and then was taken off to he had no identification on him, so he was in the ward, you know, the anonymous ward or whatever. It was a very traumatic time for her anyway. But you know what's interesting that happened is that she had sketched out so much, including lyrics and including the libretto, which Berlin had taken away to consider whether he could do this or not. And he took so much from what was there, including like sketches for songs and things like that, that he gave them 50% He split the property 50%, and he was not known for his
generosity.
A wonderful man. I won't say it, but
I will. What do
he
I
was,
care?
He was a sharp. He was a very shrewd businessman. Yeah,
right.
Let me put
Let's put it that way. Right.
And so it is highly unusual because, as you guys know, when the division for that kind of work is that the book writer gets 30%. You know, the book writer gets a third. The lyricist gets a third, and the composer gets a third. So so normally he would have been entitled to two-thirds as composer and lyricist. And she and her brother Herb Fields, who the great Broadway librettist, they collaborated on the book. So that was a very unusual arrangement. And to this day, each family has 50% of that property. Mm. So that's how it continues to be.
I have a question. That's maybe a little complex, so you can deal with as much of it as you want.
You're going to get me in trouble?
No. It's not.
Okay. I'm just kidding.
I think it's fair to say that the arts have always been considered more open than other fields in terms of embracing minorities and women in general. And yet there have been examples where it hasn't been the case. Like, for example, for many, many years, the orchestras, the great symphony orchestras, especially in Europe, were all male. They were considered almost a good old boys network. Until quite recently, the number of famous published playwrights that were female was far less than men. There do seem to have been great strides in that in the past couple of decades, fortunately. But in terms of music, writing for musical theater, do you think that women were intentionally excluded as composers?
I think that's a really good question, and it's such an interesting topic. And that is really what our show next weekend is about. It's really about the story of this journey of the women's place in the culture as far as this field goes. And it's sort of a complicated answer. My sense is that specifically nobody looked at Dorothy Fields and said, let's keep her out of this club. I think it's the premise is that there was this boys club in this songwriting, in this musical theater, and, mm-hmm. and at that time movie musicals field. Definitely a boys club, often a cigar chomping Tin Pan Alley boys club. And culturally, that's very, you know, that's a very man thing. And there were these very few, I say today, persistent, that's the buzzword, women who were able to persist and sort of elbow their way in. And the interesting thing that we talk about, the premise of the show, is that there were so few. It's so amazing how few there were. The idea that all these great songs, so many famous songs, I mean, the best is yet to come is actually the words written on Sinatra's tombstone. Mm-hmm. And all these, you know, all these shows and, you know, Sweet Charity and Once Upon a Mattress and everything in between were written by just literally a handful of people during the time of the golden age, from the jazz age till, you know, rock and roll took over. And so I think that culturally it was really difficult, I think, for women to get in.
For some reason, apparently easier, somewhat easier to get in as lyricists and never as composers, except for Mary Rodgers.
It's very rare. As composers are much rarer. Yes, it was easier to get in as lyricists. The interesting thing about there were composers though. Kay Swift. She was also the first woman to score a Broadway show with I think Fine and Dandy. Was that show right in like 1930 or something? Then there was Dana Suisse, who wrote You Ought to Be in Pictures and My Silent Love, and Anne Rennell wrote both music and lyrics. And she wrote Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf and Willow Weep for Me are her two big songs. So, but what's interesting is like where a man like Irving Berlin could start from the streets and just kind of break in and go plugging songs on Tin Pan Alley and work his way up. there was no entry point for women in that culture. They couldn't go chomping cigars and plugging songs. And what you see was really interesting. They all have a high level of sort of either education or connection, like Dorothy Fields was, that was the family business. Mary Rodgers is really interesting because she was really interesting. We were really good friends, and she was a wonderful mentor to me, and I adored her, loved her. What a fantastic person, and the funniest person ever. And I spend time in this Lyrics and Lyricists show on Mary and on just that subject, because she came of age really in the 50s and 60s. Her father was maybe the most famous Broadway composer ever. He was not particularly encouraging to her, and she was in a climate, and she talked about this. She was in a climate where it was like, girls don't do this. This is not what girls do. And then there was the added layer that if you had children, and she raised five, what do you do? I remember being on a panel with her at Lincoln Center Library one time, and she was talking about in that day, you know, what do you do? It is necessary when you're part of the creative team of a Broadway show to go out of town and work on the show. Well, what do you do if you have five young children at home or two young children at home or whatever? So that's a really pragmatic thing that culturally it just made it really, really difficult. And so I wouldn't go to the mat on this because I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I bet that Mary was the first person to have such a major Broadway success as a composer, probably since Kay Swift in 1930. Can you think of others that were in between?
My point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really unusual. And today, of course, you have like Jeanine Tesori and then pop people like Cyndi Lauper coming in. And certainly there are more. There are women composers writing. Carole Hall wrote music and lyrics to Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. But it's a great point. There are many more lyricists than composers.
Can I interrupt for a second? We have glossed over your amazing cast. We should mention them.
I've got an amazing cast. I do. No, the cast is phenomenal. Shall I tell you about the cast?
Yes,
or would you like to tell me?
Please tell us about the cast, because I want people to know that if they get over to the 92nd Street Y on Saturday the 18th to the 20th, that these five women are going to be singing this amazing music that women have written. So tell us about your cast.
So we're calling it a bouquet of divas. We've decided to go with an all woman cast, and it's lots of fun. They're all great people. We have the fabulous Emily Skinner and the fabulous Nancy Opal, and the equally fabulous Kenita Miller and Margot Seibert, and we also have Marilyn May, who is coming into town to sing just for us and blow the roof off like she always does. And the songs will be from, you know, just great songs. We have Sunny Side of the Street, and we have a few surprises, and we have some stuff from Sweet Charity, and we have It Amazes Me, and we have we've just got a lot of great stuff from a lot of the great songs that you would expect to hear from these women composers and lyricists.
Is Marilyn May going to sing Step to the Rear, which was a hit from her?
It was, right? She's actually not going to be singing that. And we thought about it, but there was not room in the show. But she's going to sing a bunch of things. And we do. Yeah. I love How Now, Dow Jones.
Me too.
I love that song and I love that show. The big problem is that you only have around 2 hours for the concert. I want to do the 8-hour version. I want to do the wall-to-wall women version
and go for 24 hours. 24 hours of women.
I think that'd be great. Yeah. We'll work on that together.
Do you know anybody at the 92nd Street Y you can get that done?
we'll bring sleeping bags. So they did it at Symphony Space, right?
Yeah.
Was it 24 hours?
Sure.
I, Was Symphony Space 24-hour one? Yeah. But the St. Anne's Warehouse is the one that we were talking about earlier. The season did a 24-hour show, a retrospect on music. It was very well received. So this
I love that idea. You hit the road to Dreamland at like 1 o'clock in the morning. You just program it from.
Oh, that's wonderful. So directed by Mark Waldrop.
By Mark Waldrop and John Otto. The music director is John Otto, who, of course, is Rosemary Clooney's music director, as well as works a lot with Michael Feinstein and Christine Ebersole. And he has a fantastic band. And that's always one of the high points of our shows.
Well, this sounds like an amazing evening that we encourage our listeners to go check it out. If you can get to town, if you are in town, get over to the Kaufman Concert Hall at 92nd Street Y and check this out. This sounds like a really great thing.
It is. We open Saturday night, the 18th, and there's a matinee and evening on Sunday and a matinee and evening on Monday as well.
Wow, that's really wonderful. Deb, thank you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio and talking about this.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
For listeners, we will have links to this stuff on the show notes. Please get over and check that out. And we look forward to the follow-ups.
I thought for once it couldn't go wrong. Not for long. I can see the way this ends. He's going to turn me down and say, can't we be friends?
Okay, so in our review section, Peter, you got a chance to see the new Broadway production of Come From Away. Tell us about this original musical.
It is an original musical in more ways than one. Well, you know, we've heard for a long time that people who need people are the luckiest people in the world, but they're especially lucky if they land in Gander, Newfoundland, when they're especially needy. And that's what happened on the morning of September 11th, 2001. All planes were suddenly diverted to places outside the country because the American airspace was not being used. And suddenly, 38 planes landed in this small Newfoundland town, which didn't even have a population of 10,000. It did, however, have an enormous airport. Now, that sounds odd with a population of 10,000, but what had happened was, in the old days, planes used to stop there to refuel, so they needed a big airport. But just like in Psycho, when the Bates Motel was next to a small road, and then they built a superhighway and nobody came to the Bates Motel, similarly speaking, once planes had bigger tanks and they didn't have to stop, suddenly there was a dinosaur airport in Gander. But not that day. That's when people had to arrive. Now, what was really also harrowing beyond belief is that they had no idea what was going on. Cell phones were rare in those days, and for that matter, connections were very hard to make from Canada to the United States. So they really didn't know why they were on the plane for, are you ready for this? 28 hours. Imagine. The next time you're on a tarmac and you have to stay there for a half hour, think about these people who spent time 56 times what you're enduring there. So, and of course, chaos, because nobody knew what was going on. Why was this happening? And all they were hearing is, we're going to be here for some time. Nobody wanted to say what the official explanation was, because that seemed to be worse. Because no matter what your ideas were of what was going on, it may not have been as terrible as what really happened in New York City that day. So, sounds like a dour story, doesn't it? It's amazing how much humor is in it. It's amazing how much sentimentality of a not treacly nature is in it. It's a wonderful show. We hear about feel-good musicals. This is a feel-great musical, because what was so impressive was to see that the moment the people in Gander heard that this was happening, all they could think about was helping. These are really lovely people, and they certainly spent their time, their energy, their money. They took people into their homes that they didn't know. And the irony is that the passengers were wary of going into their homes. Hey, I better watch my wallet. Maybe they're going to steal. No, this is not who these people are at all. But so terrific to see people rise to the occasion and do a wonderful job. It's a very odd musical where it comes to music. There are very few songs as such. Most of the time, a performer will sing a line, followed by a different performer singing a line, followed by a different performer singing a line. There are 15 songs listed in the program. 14 of them say Company. One of them is a solo by the pilot, who is Jen Colella, who gives you her backstory and how she became a pilot and how difficult it was for her. But for the most part, it really is a songless musical. There are, they do have songs listed in the program, but I doubt if you heard any of these pieces, which is the best way of putting it, or musical quips even, that you would be able to give the name of the song. But still, what we have here is, well, remember how Frank Lesser said that The Most Happy Fella was, when they asked him, was it a musical, was it an opera? He said, it's a musical with a lot of music. This is really a play with a lot of music in a strange sort of way. Most of it is sung, and yet it comes across as a play because you really don't feel like you're hearing songs. This is not meant as criticism. We're always talking about new ways to do musicals, and this is a new way of doing it. And Irene Sankoff and her husband, by the way, and they've been together a while, and you might think from the name Irene that indeed you should, pardon the expression, she's an older woman, because that seems to be a name of a different era. No, Irene's a very young woman, and so is her husband, David Hine. And they have done remarkable work here in creating something out of a tragedy to make it so uplifting. If there aren't tears in your eyes when you finish seeing Come From Away, I'm going to be very, very surprised, because it's so moving as we get to know each of the people, each of the stories, each of the anxieties they have aside from 9/11, and how friendships were really forged over a 5-day period before they could leave in what had to be the strangest, quotation marks, vacation, quotation marks, that anybody could ever spend.
So, Peter, this is getting a lot of good buzz and good reviews. It's a horse race for best musical, isn't it?
You bet. And, you know, there is only one human being I know who's smart about musicals, of perhaps the 36 I've talked to before I saw it, who didn't love it, love it, love it. So I think if you're a musical theater aficionado, you're going to respond to it and you'll appreciate its new directions and its values. I think you will. So I would be a bit surprised. In fact, even when I was hearing all the buzz on it, you know, they were in San Diego, they were in Seattle, they were in Washington, D.C. I was hearing buzz from a theater. People I know who saw it there said, you're not going to believe what you're going to see. And even at that point, I was saying to myself, I wouldn't be surprised if this is our best musical.
I think that the challenge for Come From Away is the title.
Right.
I think it's hard to describe
it's
what
true.
That show is in that
it
title.
It is. And I fully agree. And, you know, what they're talking about is these people have come from away.
Sure.
You know, but it is an awkward title, and I bet it's one that's going to get misquoted a great deal, that nobody is going to get those three words in a row correct. Maybe not nobody, but there will be a number of people who are going to say, have you seen Come Away From This, you know, something like that. You know, and, you know, it's
actually
it's,
somebody the other day asked me, somebody called me at work and said, can you tell me who's the press agent for Come Fly Away?
It's an easy mission. Come Fly With Me. So all of these we're going to hear. But
I also think that I could be wrong, but I think that in a couple of years, people will retroactively look back and say, oh, you know, there's nothing wrong with that title.
I know. It reminds me of a friend of mine back in the 60s who said, well, two bombs are opening out of town tonight, and you can tell from their titles. The Time of the Barracudas. Well, you know, that turned out, that closed out of town. And the other one, Barefoot in the Park. I mean, what terrible titles, you know. So you're right. Once something becomes very well known in a brand, suddenly the title isn't a problem anymore.
Exactly.
Well, let's move on to the next one, which also has a terrible title and hardly nobody knows what it means. Michael got a chance to see The Glass Menagerie. So, Michael, tell us about The Glass Menagerie.
Well, I did not hate it as much as I thought I would.
And they're putting that quote on the side of the
That's
theater.
A pull quote. That's true. I didn't hate it as much. Michael Portanti of Broadway Radio. There it is.
Go on.
It's a tribute. It's tribute to the genius of Tennessee Williams that his play triumphs over this incredibly strange, perverse production by directed by Sam Gold. Also, I enjoyed it far more than the recent Othello that Mr. Gold horribly misdirected down at New York Theater Workshop. And I think that's because that was a little different in terms of specifically resetting Othello in the Iraq War. Whereas in this case, the Glass Menagerie hasn't necessarily been put in a particular new place and time. It's just a very, very minimalist production with basically no set other than a table, an old gramophone. At one point, the sign, the neon sign for the Paradise Ballroom across the street. There's also a rain effect, but it's basically no sets, basically no props. I don't know what, you know, I mean, I certainly don't think that most of it added to the text at all, and a lot of it detracted from it. There were some wonderful moments in it that would have been, I think, even more wonderful in a more traditional production. For example, there was a physical affection that we saw between Tom and his mother, Amanda, that I have never seen before. And I thought it worked beautifully because they really do love each other when they're not at each other's throats. And I don't think it's in the script. I've directed a production many years ago, but I don't think it's written in the script. So maybe that's why we haven't seen it more. And I don't know if I've ever seen it. But for example, in the first scene where Amanda's recalling, you know, for the umpteenth time, how she would be received by all these gentlemen callers when she was a youth in the South. The Tom and Laura are indulging her, and they're rolling their eyes a little bit and occasionally repeating some of her lines, some of the names of her beaux, even as, you know, saying them as she says them, because they've heard the stories so often. But then at one point, Tom kind of takes her by the hand and pulls her over and has her sit in his lap, and he embraces her. And I just thought that was wonderful. And then they also have a similar physical embrace later on after they have their huge argument and Tom apologizes. So that I thought was really wonderful. There was also an interesting moment at the very end where Tom, looking back at all this in flashback, says, just talking years later, presumably, about how he can't, he can't forget those days with his mother and his sister in that little apartment in St. Louis. And he tries to, but he can't. And he says the famous line, "Blow out your candles, Laura." Well, in this case, Madison Ferris playing Laura literally shook her head no, and did not blow out the candles. And I thought that was really quite effective. So, but again, there was all this nonsense to go along with these few moments of beautiful, directorial decisions. For example, right from the beginning, Amanda says, Tom does his opening monologue, and Amanda says, "Tom, we can't say grace till you come to the table." Well, neither she nor Laura are at the table, so that didn't make any sense. Then normally they start, they start eating normal food at a table, and one of Amanda's first lines is, "Don't push your food with your fingers, Tom." Well, in this case, he's eating an apple. they're not standing at the table, and he's eating an apple, and he's not obviously pushing it with his fingers. So, you know, it takes you out of it, because if only for a second, he's like, why is she saying that he's pushing his food with his fingers when he's not doing that? Is she insane? I don't get it. What else? Much has been made. Much, of course, has been made of the fact that Madison Ferris, who plays Laura, is herself actually severely physically disabled. And there again, it's interesting to an extent, but then it gets you thinking, well, is this supposed to mean that? Let me backtrack. In the original script, it's supposed to be just that Laura has basically a slight limp. I mean, it's been done to different extents in different productions, but that's basically what it's supposed to be. She's not in a wheelchair. She can walk on her own, et cetera, et cetera. But here she can't walk. She drags herself across the floor when she's not in a wheelchair, and it's just a very severe physical disability. So, but yet their lines remain with Amanda and later the gentleman caller, and saying all you have is a little physical defect, hardly noticeable even. And so then you think, well, does this mean is the director trying to tell us that that all these people are insane, or is he trying to tell us that this is how the family sees Laura, even though she isn't actually that bad off? Are we to think that that's the way Laura sees herself, even though she's not that bad off? Or is it a combination of those two? And I just think it, you know, all of that wondering, again, takes you out of the play. Laura has a line, she supposedly has been going to been taking a course, at business college, but she hasn't been going because she got so nervous and she didn't fit in at all. And so finally, when Amanda finds out about this and she fesses up, Amanda says, "What have you been doing all day?" And she says, "I've been walking. I've been walking to the zoo. I've been walking." Mm-hmm. Well, she hasn't been walking. So you know, it takes you out of it again. What else? The famous, beautiful scene between the gentleman caller and Laura, the very long but beautiful scene that has worked in every production that I've ever seen, it's played beautifully here by Madison Ferris and Finn Wittrock, but so dimly lit. It's seemingly only with the natural light of a candelabra that... You know, come on, Sam Gold. Couldn't you have just pumped it up a little bit for the sake of the audience for whom you're supposedly performing the play, not yourself? That was really kind of annoying. I was close enough that I felt I could sort of see most of their physical expressions, their facial expressions. But I think people further back probably would have had a huge problem with that. And some people have reported that. So, that's my sum up. William's triumphs. I do wish, in retrospect, that I had seen Sally Field in what apparently was a far more traditional production at the Kennedy Center years ago, for which she earned rave reviews, and so did the production. I'm glad I got to see her now, but I wish I had seen her then. That's pretty much what I have to say. We can talk further when Peter and or James see the production.
Okay, so Peter and I will revisit this in the coming weeks and let you know our thoughts on it. Next up, Peter saw White Guy on the Bus at 59 East 59. So tell us about that, Peter.
Yeah, this is Bruce Graham's new play, and what's really wonderful about it is that for the first half hour, you're going to say, "Oh, this is so unbelievable. Oh, my God, this wouldn't happen. You mean to tell me a guy who has a Mercedes rides on the bus? What's he doing riding on a bus when he says he's got a Mercedes? He claims he loves public transportation. Are you kidding me? This Wall Street mover and shaker, or as Sondheim would say, shaper, would this really happen? I mean, come on." And yes, it's lovely to think that there he is just striking up a conversation with a black girl. It's wonderful that if this would happen. But we don't believe that it would happen. So, my God, what's going on? And then we really hate him because he tells the girl that he's not married. And we've seen so many scenes where he's been with his wife. So obviously what's going on here is that he wants to have sex with her. Well, Bruce Graham is far smarter than I am, I'll tell you, because none of this where you think it's going has any relationship to where it does go. And he makes a phenomenal plot work superbly well. So if you want surprises, this is the play to see. I will admit that many of the conversations that I had among people about black and white relationships, certainly an argument you've heard before, there's not much new in the way of those conversations. But the plot is so dynamically interested, and Bob Cuccioli is certainly the perfect person to play this because he has that wonderful charm and that wonderful sense of menace when he needs it. And he certainly needs it here because this play will get menacing. So as a result, I can easily recommend White Guy on the Bus and hope that you do go see it and see if you can figure out what's going on after that first half hour.
Well, that sounds incredibly effective if a playwright and director and actors can pull that off. If you think one thing and you're thinking negative things and then suddenly something clicks and you're like, oh, that sounds incredibly effective.
Yes, there may be more negative thoughts than you have originally, but that's another story, literally and figuratively. So, yes, I can definitely recommend it.
Great.
59 is 59. Is seemingly the place to see a lot of new, interesting things.
Oh, it's a wonderful place.
Review that we've been doing from 59 has been some great stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Michael, you got over to the Booth Theater where you saw Significant Others. Tell us about this play.
Well, I had seen the play off-Broadway, and I had mixed to positive feelings about it. About the play itself, and I guess maybe mixed to negative feelings about the performance of Gideon Glick in the central role. Seeing it again, I would say that my feelings about both improved. What's the word? Not improved. Is that the word? I had better feelings about both.
Better is synonymous with improved.
Michael, I recall your writing once that you made your peace with the Hello Dolly movies, so maybe you made your peace with this play too.
or maybe I was just able to appreciate it on a different level and maybe it just worked better. I don't know. It's about this fellow, Jordan Berman, who's in his late 20s. And as it starts out, he has three very close female friends. And as the show opens, one of them has just become engaged and everyone is happy for her. And they're all celebrating and very, very happy. And then as the play continues, one by one, the other two close female friends also find men, but Jordan is left partnerless. And this begins to become a big, big issue for him. He starts to feel like there's something wrong with him. He's afraid of losing these people as friends, if not totally, just obviously they're going to be spending time with their husbands. And so less time for him. With one of the friends, Laura, played by Lindsay Mendez, he actually at the beginning, they have one of those deals where if neither one of us has found someone in 10 years, maybe we'll hook up. This despite the fact that Jordan is very gay. So they do say that, and they do obviously love each other, so maybe they're contemplating a that kind of a marriage. But she eventually finds someone, and so that's not an option for Jordan. Let me just mention the full cast, by the way. Barbara Barry plays Jordan's grandmother. John Bellman plays several roles, more on that later. Gideon Glick is Jordan Berman, Sass Goldberg, Kiki, Rebecca Naomi Jones, Vanessa, Lindsay Mendez, Laura, and Luke Smith, also three male roles. I think a huge problem with this production, which is basically a carbon copy of what I saw off Broadway, is that this is a case where doubling of roles really does not work, because John Bellman, for example, has to play not only this guy at who Jordan is obsessed with at work and really wants to date and go out with and maybe have a life with, but then he also has to play the husbands of the eventual husbands of two of the women. And then Luke Smith plays another gay guy at the office. He plays the husband of one of the other women, and it all gets very confusing, especially in the beginning when John Bellman is coming on, you know, in one scene as one person, and then the next scene is somebody else. John Bellman is very tall and very striking looking and very good looking, and you're like, oh, has Jordan's friend started dating this guy at work that he's in love with? No, but it's two different people. So I just thought this was one of the worst cases of doubling I've ever seen. I understand, you know, that they need to keep the budget down and they can't hire that many actors, but it would have worked far better if they could just have had one person in all of those roles. The writing, for the most part, I think, by Joshua Harmon is very good. There are some really questionable jokes. At one point, Jordan jokes about not having HIV.
Wow.
There are jokes, quote unquote, about abortion. At one point, one of the characters says something like, if you're going to have children, if a couple is going to have children, you have to have at least two kids so that if one of them dies, the other one won't be a single child. You know, and I thought, and the audience, I think, even gasped at that. So I don't know. I think that sometimes the humor gets a little too edgy. What else? There's another thing that I saw of as a flaw is that when Jordan and his women are together, they tend to act like 12-year-olds. And it gets a little annoying sometimes, especially in terms of Gideon Glick, when his voice when he goes for volume and when his voice rises, it becomes extremely annoying. But also the women too, like they tend to do a lot of screaming and just acting very childlike. So I had a bad reaction to that. Although I will say that the friend with whom I saw the play, he really loved it, and I mentioned to him this objection about them acting like really acting like children. And he said, well, you know, I have to tell you, just 2 days ago I got together with, and then he mentioned some mutual friends of ours that we've known for like literally 35 or 40 years. He said, and I have to tell you that when we were together alone in the car, we were acting like children too. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, you know, you do have a point. And I think that's a valid one. And I'm going to have to reassess that in terms of this play. So I would say that it's definitely worth seeing. I don't know how well it's going to do on Broadway. In another time, it might not have been brought to Broadway and might have just had a successful extended run off Broadway. But as we all know, that's less and less common nowadays. Also, it's not to belabor it, but this is a kind of interesting situation where the off-Broadway production of this play was reviewed by Charles Isherwood for the New York Times very, very favorably. And it would have been assumed that he would have re-reviewed it on Broadway because that's the Times policy. Or sometimes they will reprint the original review if it's the exact same production. But in this case, Charles Isherwood, of course, was fired. So Ben Brantley went to review the play. And although the first paragraph of the review, as I recall, was very, very positive. It then became much more mixed and it was certainly not the kind of review that would sell necessarily cause a stampede at the box office. So I don't think it's doing that well. I've heard it's not doing that well and we will see what happens. The play does deserve a life, despite whatever flaws that I mentioned in the writing and the performance and the direction by Trip Cullman.
So you reviewed it on Broadway Radio in an episode in June of 2015. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It was at the Roundabout Theater Company. Roundabout doesn't have any involvement in this Broadway production, do they?
Yes, they do. I was just about to look at that when you mentioned it. It says at the top, Jeffrey Richards, Roundabout Theater Company, Rebecca Gold, Ronald Frankel, and then below that, like 20 people, of course, including the Schubert Organization. Ira Pittleman and Tom Holtz are also among the producers.
Yeah, it's having a rough time at the box office right now. So we'll have to see how it does. Word of mouth has been, from friends of mine, been pretty good that say that it's very, very funny. So we'll have to see how this shakes out over. What were you going to say?
Much of it is very, very funny, but also much of it is very moving for anyone who has felt like he or she has been in that position where all their friends are you know, coupling or getting married. Yeah. And you're just like, what do I do now?
All right. So let's move forward into the Gravedigger's Lullaby at the Beckett Theater, which Peter saw. So, Peter, tell us about Gravedigger's.
Yeah, this is a very pungent play because you do actually see this man working for a living. And I mean, he is working. It is very hard, needless to say, to be a grave digger. And there he is with his friend, frenemy, enemy, co-worker, a guy who certainly gives him a great deal of grief and will impact his future tremendously. But there they are, shoveling it out, digging those graves, and it's a tough living, and he doesn't want to do it specifically, not because of the physical work. He'll do physical work, but because he's not making enough money to support his wife and his child. Now, the problem is when he gets home is that he's not going to get much rest because that kid just born, their daughter, just will not stop crying. And this has really impacted the marriage. The wife is frustrated. He's frustrated. They don't want to have sex anymore because they're just not in the mood and the kid will wake them up anyway. So it's a real problem. Well, some rich man's father has died, and a conversation ensues between the rich man and our gravedigger, and we think that they might be able to reach some terms in which the rich man will hire the gravedigger for his company. Now, this brings up all sorts of questions of class distinction about whether or not a man can make a transition from being a gravedigger to working in an office, whether or not the rich man will treat him condescendingly. Does the rich man trust that the gravedigger really will work hard? Will he like him? Is he right for the position? These sound very mundane, but I'm happy to say that the playwright does a much better job in doing it than I'm describing it. And this intermissionless work on Theater Row really deserves a hearing. It sounds conventional, and yet it's an example of taint what you do, it's the way that you do it. And because the writing is so effective and works so well with these terrific actors, just terrific, there aren't many of them, but there are four of them, and they're sensational in what they're doing. And I'm looking to find their names. And all right, so here we go. Jeremy Beck, Jeffrey C. Hawkins, Ted Koch, and Lisa Velton. She plays the Velton Smith, sorry. Jeff Talbot's the playwright, and Jen Thompson has done a wonderful job of directing. So if you have a night free and you're on the cusp of Theater Row, do drop in. I think you're going to be far more mesmerized by it from my pretty warm description of it. It's a play that also has a tremendous surprise at the end that will make you, well, I don't know if it'll make your heart break, but it will make it strain. And but it may come back together again after you see the resolution that Jeff Talbot has given The Gravedigger's Lullaby.
All right, that's at the Beckett Theater on Theater Row, which plays through April 1st. Michael, I think you were downstairs or upstairs from the Gravedigger's Lullaby, where you were at Louisiana Purchase at Musicals Tonight, also in Theater Row at the Lion Theater. So tell us about that.
Yes, I got to. I usually see the musicals tonight shows on the first weekend, but this one I saw on the second of the two weekends. It closes today, actually, as we're recording March 12th. Louisiana Purchase, 1940, music and lyrics by Irving Berlin, libretto by Maury Riskind, based on a story by B.G. De Silva. This production was directed and choreographed by Donald Brenner, musical director and vocal arranger James Stenborg, and I loved it. I went in totally cold to this show. There is a recording of a concert that was done some years ago at Carnegie Hall that I never even heard that. It's just something that I never got around to. And as often happens in a case like this, when I know something like this is coming up, I think, well, I could bone up on it, you know, by listening to that recording and et cetera, or I could go in cold and see how I react. And there is something wonderful about going into a very old show, completely cold, and just having it have its effect on you. And I just loved it. Maury Riskind was a master at writing the book for this kind of silly, very, very funny musical comedy, Louisiana Purchase. I won't even try to get into the details of the plot, but it is, in fact, set in Louisiana and in New Orleans, and it deals with political issues and political corruption to a certain extent, and it has a lot of lines about Democrats versus Republicans that, of course, you know, all have far deeper meaning now than they did even at the time. So I don't know if that was partly behind Mel Miller's decision to do it now, but I think that was great. And oddly enough, at the performance I saw, the audience was they seemed to like the show, but they didn't respond that well to the political humor. Maybe it's just because it was absolutely freezing out and people were in a bad mood. You know, I've noticed that on very cold days, sometimes audiences don't respond to comedies. But anyway, I responded to the political humor, and I think that I really have a great respect for Maury Riskind. People just don't write that kind of comedy anymore, and I just love it. And it's surprising how very, very little of it was dated. This also, musicals tonight shows lately have been far more produced. They no longer hold scripts. This one was completely costumed, and they did have a full set. It was a unit set of this cafe in New Orleans. And so, you know, I mean, there weren't scene changes, which I'm sure there were in the original, but only in one scene that supposedly took place in a hotel room was it obvious that it wasn't supposed to be the cafe. So that wasn't an issue. And the cast was just wonderful. Beth B. Austin, Sam Beasley, Tom Brown III, Corey Desjardins, Elizabeth Evans, Michael J. Farina, as the senator, who Michael J. Farina I have seen over the years in several different shows. I saw him in a production of Company, and I saw him in one of the very few productions of Philemon that I've ever seen. He played the title role in that years ago, and he was wonderful. Michael Fasano, Colleen Great, Stacey Jo Johnston, Morgan McCann, Jay Parranata, Charles Ruby, Lily Tobin, Tony Triano, and Kristen Weatherington. So I'm so glad I went. I have been quite sick over the past few days. I almost missed it, and I'm so glad I didn't. It was really just wonderful.
What's really interesting about Louisiana Purchase is the way it starts, because ostensibly a lawyer has been sent the script of Louisiana Purchase by the authors to indicate whether or not they can do it because it is political satire. Will they get sued? Will they get in trouble? So in an age where shows always opened with a chorus, this one opened with this disclaimer. And the fact that the authors were worried about taking on the presidency is rather quaint and charming to us, because on Saturday Night Live, you can see Alec Baldwin stating outright that he's President 45. But back then, you know, they worried about naming names. Even 3 years earlier, when Rodgers and Hart wrote a musical in which George M. Cohan played President Roosevelt, they were nervous about that, too. So, and much of the plot relies on political scandal, being caught with a girl, that type of thing, how it could ruin a political career. Now, of course, it's brushed off as locker room talk, but back then it was far more serious. So, yes, Louisiana Purchase does have a lot to say still today, and I'm glad you got to see it.
Yeah, and I assume it's written this way, that the chorus does the disclaimer as a choral number.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so, I going in cold and seeing that, I was like, this is so brilliant and so clever and so funny. And also, although this score, I would say, does not include one hit song, not one single hit, really, it's excellent. And I would say it has some of the best, most clever, wittiest lyrics that Berlin ever, ever wrote. I really suggest getting a hold of that recording.
It was his first musical comedy. Up until then, he'd only written reviews for Broadway. Yeah, of course, he did Hollywood films and Follow the Fleet and Top Hat before this came along. But here was his first real musical comedy, and it wound up being his biggest hit to date. It ran over a year and was made into a movie with Bob Hope, which is fairly faithful, though certain songs were dropped, including Carol Bruce's The Lord Done Fix Up My Soul, which is a second act barn burner, which and one of the reasons it may not be in the movie is because Vera Zorina, who was playing the lead, didn't like that Carol Bruce was stealing her thunder. Carol Bruce wound up on Life magazine, and Vera Zorina was furious. So when the movie was made, they cast Farina. They did not cast Carol Bruce. And I always wondered if Vera Zorina said that number is not going to be in the movie. It's done as background music. Now, again, probably not, because how much power did Vera Zorina have in Hollywood? But it is something that has crossed my mind from time to time.
All right. So, next up, Peter got a chance to get over to the Storm Theater's production of Deconstruction, which is down at the Grand Hall at St. Mary's Church on Grand Street. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Well, I'm sorry to say it's not a grand hall at all. That's part of the problem. What it is it's the basement of a church. And this is not a room that was made to be a theater, not at all. And the acoustics are truly god-awful beyond any human being's comprehension. And I'm sorry to say the director has exacerbated the problem, because it's not a real stage. It's a hall, you know, used for many different functions. There are three levels to it, three like big steps, let's say. And he's directed the first half hour of the play in the step that's the farthest away from us. And with the acoustics so terrible, it's very hard to hear. So a lot of lines are lost. I do believe Jonathan Leaf's play is better than it's being served here. A lot better, in fact. It deals with Mary McCarthy, who's having an affair with Paula Matt, names you might know, and her friend Hannah Arendt gets involved too. Now, who knew that this was going on? We know about Mary McCarthy's feud with Lillian Hellman and other things. We know that she wrote The Group, which was an enormous bestseller in the early 60s, that every adolescent boy got for chapter two, and had wonderful times as a result. Oh, believe me. Anyway, so, but he's uncovered this very lesser-known story, and he has made something of it that is very, very solid. I think if I heard all of it, maybe I'd be able to do that. And you might say, oh, it's probably a hearing. Go ahead. I challenge anybody to go to the Storm Theater and see if anything's different, if you have a different opinion from the one that I have. Again, you know, I feel bad for people who want to start a theater company and don't have the resources, and they take what they can get. And it really shows a great devotion to theater. But I'm also reminded of something that Clay Richardson said when he talked about the Broadway production of The Grass Harp. When that was produced in 1971, musicals were starting to cost around $1 million. The Grass Harp came in for $162,000, and they didn't even have window cards. They didn't didn't have any advertising. They just couldn't afford it. And he said to me, I've often thought if you're going to do it that way, you shouldn't do it at all. And maybe, you know, if you have to rent a basement in a church where the acoustics are bad and there's no real stage. And again, I blame the director for putting it so far away because the final scene is final two scenes are played much closer and they work much better. But maybe you shouldn't do it at all. Maybe you should wait until you're able to afford something good. I know that's a terrible thing to say, and I hate to stomp on anybody's artistic dreams, but you know, there we are too, and it's hard on the audience too, sitting on folding chairs that are close together, on risers that a riser that you're afraid is going to fall apart at any minute. So it's sad, it really is. But I guess if we're going to look at the glasses half full, we have Jonathan Leaf's play, and we have a devoted group of artists who really work very hard to make something happen out of virtually nothing.
Okay, and finally this morning, Michael, you got over to Wagner College to see Titanic. So tell us about this.
Well, I had not long ago seen a production of Titanic down at the Signature Theater down in Arlington, Virginia, and that was really great. And I have always loved the show despite its flaws, and so I absolutely wanted to go see it at Wagner College. And it was fun too, actually. I mean, you know, obviously we took the ferry both ways. It was a little more odd to get on a boat after seeing.
Oh, right.
But not exactly the same situation, you know, although both my friend and I joked about it. This was a wonderful production. Wagner had done this show several years ago, and I think it was one of their biggest hits. So they did it again, and it was really great, directed by Drew Scott Harris. And now here's a case where, you know, since it is a college, blessedly free of doubling. And the cast was so huge, and it makes a big difference, and especially in a show like this where you're supposed to be showing this huge cross-section of humanity, of all these different classes of people and ages and ethnicity is not so much, but yes, that too. Involved in this incredible tragedy, which of course didn't start out as a tragedy, but started out as the most exciting thing that was ever going to happen to them in their lives. And I guess, well, turned out to be exciting also, but in a very different and very tragic way. So it was just very well done. Although the orchestra was severely reduced from what you heard on Broadway, that was done very skillfully by the music director, Dr. Laurie Young. Choreography by Carissa Belanda was great. The cast was strong across the board. The three Kates were really good, and very simple set. The one thing I did not really like was that they basically had everyone in dressed in black for most of the show until the end, when they were supposed to have their sort of resurrection sort of kind of thing. But that I didn't really like that, but it didn't bother me that much. And I have got to mention to you, you know, sometimes we say, write this name down. In this case, it's two names you have to write down, and they're twin brothers and they're sophomores, John Drinkwater and Matthew Drinkwater. John Drinkwater plays Charles Clark, which was I believe the Don Stevenson role on Broadway. And an interesting thing there is that role and his vis-a-vis were severely cut in the original Broadway production, I guess just for time. Caroline is his vis-a-vis, and they basically run away from England because they want to get married and their families don't want them to. And so their duet, I Give You My Hand, was not in the original production, but I think I guess it's been basically reinstated as into the show. You know, kind of globally, because they did do it when I saw it at Signature and they did it at Wagner. And you kind of have to have it, because even though it's not that great a song, but otherwise it's like, well, who are these two people who just occasionally come on and sing a few things and then go off again. So they now got their duet back, and John Drinkwater played Charles Clark, and Matthew Drinkwater played Frederick Barrett, who is the Stoker, which is arguably the best male role in the entire show. And these two guys, as I said, first of all, they're sophomores. So Wagner presumably has them for two more years, unless Hollywood or Broadway or both snap them up. They both have beautiful voices. They're both great actors, and they are so good looking. I can't really describe it. John Drinkwater is a sophomore theater performance major and is thrilled to have gotten to work with the cast and crew of Titanic. Recent credits include Bill in Trojan Women 2.0, Agent Smith in Iolanthe, Norbert in The Great American Trailer Park Musical, Sky Masterson in Guys and Dolls. This work and more can be seen on his YouTube channel, Drinkwater Brothers. They have a YouTube channel. And Matthew Drinkwater, a sophomore theater major, performance major, is thrilled to be taking on the beautiful, heartbreaking, and true story of Titanic. In the spring, he'll be taking on the role of Jean-Michel in Wagner's main stage production of La Cage aux Folles. Matthew is also a member of the Wagner College football team.
Huh.
So there you have it. Just check out Drinkwater Brothers' YouTube channel, and you will see what I mean. They, you know, unless they don't want to, they are both going to be big, big stars.
Great.
Perhaps they should do a production of West Side Story where one plays Tony and one plays Nardo.
Well, I was trying to think. The problem is that they are, I believe it seems to me that they are identical twins, and in fact they seem to have lightened John's hair for this show, and they gave him a little mustache in order for the audience not to be completely confused as to which one of them but I was also trying to think of what shows they could do that have actual twins, and of course there's The Boys from Syracuse, which would be amazing. There again, they might have to do a little something to one of them to so that we would have a clue as to which was which. And then what's the other play? Isn't it Ring Around the Moon that has twins?
Right, Ring Around the Moon. Ring Around the Moon. John Onoue play has twins. Edward Albee wrote a play where there were twins too, both with the same name even. One was Otto with a capital O and one was Otto with a lower O. I think it was called Me, Myself, and I or something like that. So those are they.
All right, so I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com and subscribe. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. There are many ways you can get This Week on Broadway. One of them is iHeartRadio, Google Play, TuneIn, which is the app for your Amazon Echo. So you can say, hey, Alexa, play Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway, and play us for you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Michael, for Peter, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. All right, Peter, so give us the trivia answer for 2 weeks ago.
Well, the question was, what composer never won a Pulitzer Prize but worked on musical with four people, each of whom had already won one by the time they all started collaborating? Now, boy, this got a lot of traction. Jed Slaughter said, well, this is probably not the answer you had in mind, but your choice of worked on musicals with Pulitzer winner leads me to Jeanine Tesori as a technically possible solution. She wrote Caroline the Chains with Tony Kushner and Shrek with David Lindsay Abaire and is currently part of the producing team of Sunday in the Park, which adds Sondheim and Lapine as Pulitzer winners. Yeah, that's a good answer. So Jack Leshner said, Irving Berlin worked with previous Pulitzer Prize winner Moss Hart and Robert E. Sherwood on Miss Liberty, and later worked with previous Pulitzer Prize winner Howard Lindsay and Russell Crouse on Mr. President. So no argument, you know. Jake Leonard then said, well, Bob Merrill collaborated with George Abbott in New Girl in Town, and Edward Albee in Abe Burrows and Holly Golightly Breakfast at Tiffany's. And you could say he collaborated with Eugene O'Neill for New Girl in Town and Take Me Along. Well, not really, you know, because Eugene O'Neill had gone to his final reward or punishment, whichever it was. I'll tell you who I had in mind. I had Kurt Vile in mind, who did Johnny Johnson with Paul Green. Abraham's Bosom was the name of the Pulitzer winner. Knickerbocker Holiday with Maxwell Anderson, Pulitzer winner of both the houses. And Lady in the Dark with Moss Hart, You Can't Take It With You, and Ira Gershwin of The I Sing. But both Jack and Jake later pointed out, they went back to work and they said, oh, it's Kurt Weill, it's Kurt Weill. Because, and they all mentioned three of those, but then they also mentioned one that I had forgotten, Elmer Rice, who wrote Street Scene. And of course, that was Kurt Weill's opera back in the late 40s. So actually, it's five Pulitzer Prize winners that he worked with. And what's really so impressive is here's this guy coming from Germany who's written this 12-performance flop on Broadway called The Threepenny Opera, and all these blue-chip writers are hot to work with him. Mm. I think that really is something. So, God bless our immigration policy to let him in the country.
Thank you.
Okay. So what's the new one?
What very famous one-word musical that has nine letters in its title originally went by an eight-letter title? All eight letters were included in the title we know, but one letter was added up front. So what was the original title, and what is the now famous title?
Okay, so if you have an answer to that trivia question, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we will let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I have no idea what that answer is either.
especially since he said famous, didn't he? A famous musical. So it's not something obscure. It's probably staring us right in the face. I'll have to think of it.